80s.
Oh, first of all, what day is it today?
Today is the 12th of May, 2015.
Okay. You're on.
In the 1980s, I was still having to put in a certain amount of time fixing up old houses and renting them out for a while until I couldn't stand being a landlord anymore, and then I would turn around and sell them. But I never lost contact entirely with my various social issues, particularly the farm labor movement. In 1982, I was invited to the 20th anniversary of the founding of the Farm Workers Association, which had been started by Cesar Chavez in Delano in 1962. For some reason, the 20th anniversary celebration was held in San Jose. Well, I can think of a reason why they might have done that. That's where Chavez himself spent a good many years. And in fact, he had been discovered by Father Donald MacDonald, who started him on the path to social activism. But I suspect maybe the main reason to have the anniversary there was that Chavez's mother was still alive. I think she was probably approaching 100 years old. And she was able to attend this meeting, whereas she probably wouldn't have been able to go to Delano. In any event, I met a number of my old friends there, including Chavez himself, Wendy Gopal, who had had much to do with the organization I started called Citizens for Farm Labor back in 1963. And Father Thomas McCullough was there. Hadn't seen him for years. This was also the occasion on which Chavez himself hearing that I had been dropped from the Department of Public Health. Chavez knew that I had spent some time in the health department studying the effects of pesticides on farm workers. And when he heard that I was at liberty, he said, "Why don't you come and work for us?" He was much interested in the pesticide issue because he was much interested in boycotting agricultural products as part of his strategy of organizing the workers. However, I had to tell him that I had family commitments and it would be impossible for me to move to Delano. Another issue that got me involved once again took place in 1986 when the Congress of the United States was grappling with the problem of immigration somewhat in the way that they are still. There was a big problem with illegal immigration then, as there still is. And a senator named Alan Simpson from Wyoming and a congressman named Mazzoli from New Jersey, as I recall, after holding a lot of hearings, came up with an omnibus immigration reform bill, popularly known as the Simpson-Mazzoli Act. And it was going to reform all the things that were wrong with the immigration system up to that point. It was going to cure the problem of employers hiring illegal immigrants by, for the first time, penalizing the employers. That is, if they were caught. And as far as workers, there was a provision that if domestic workers could not be found in sufficient numbers to do certain types of jobs, that guest worker programs could be instituted. They didn't use that language, but they knew that the Becerra program had been very unpopular in its time, and they avoided the use of that word, and somebody came up with this euphemism. And so I was like an old war horse smelling smoke, or whatever the cliche is, and began writing a critique of this aspect of this so-called immigration reform bill. Well, as was my besetting sin, I was behind the curve and didn't finish my critique in time to do any good, because the Congress passed this bill and it was signed into law by the president at that time in 1986, I guess it would have been. Would have been Reagan. Well, there was a confluence of other interests of mine, one of which was my new friendship with Joe Murphy. And Joe was not only a former Wobbly with lots and lots of anecdotes about the rough and tumble life he used to live, but I also learned that he was interested in some of the cultural aspects of life, including writers. And somehow or other, it had come to his attention that the remaining daughter of Jack London was still alive and well and living in the town of Glen Ellen, which is where Jack London's ranch was located. Although she had never actually lived at the ranch, she was living in an apartment owned by the manager of a bookstore that specialized in the works of Jack London. And Joe Murphy liked the idea of having gatherings of writers and would-be writers at his place in Occidental. And so one day he arranged to have Becky London driven from Glen Ellen to Occidental for the purposes of meeting me as another sometime writer. And we had a good time trying to bring out her memories of her father. Becky herself, unlike her sister Joan, my co-author of the book that I believe I have mentioned before in these ramblings, Becky was no writer. In fact, I think she took some pride in the distinction between herself and her sister. Joan was a political radical, was a heavy smoker and drinker, and Becky London was a very conventional housewife. But she was a charming old lady, and she did have some memories of her father. It was very, very interesting to me. Now, at about this time, we're talking about the late 1980s. It came to my attention that an old friend of mine named Trevor Thomas, whom I had known way back when I was research director for the Agricultural Workers Organizing Committee. At that time, he was the legislative representative of the Friends Committee on Legislation. He was a lobbyist trying to get the legislature of the state of California to act on laws that would be of some help to agricultural workers. And in that connection, I had gotten to know Trevor. Later on, he became the director of the station KPFA, and I got to know him even better during the troubled times at that station. It was always in trouble. By 1987, he had long since been relieved of his duties there, and he was at liberty. And in fact, I think that he was on the verge of poverty. He probably had a small pension from Social Security, and that was about it. So somehow or other, I got the idea of combining my knowledge of Jack London's two daughters. I had known Joan well, and I was in the process of getting to know Becky. And it occurred to me that there had never been a proper document, a television document of the sort that they run on the public broadcasting system periodically. never a proper document about the life and times of Jack London, and he was a very, very colorful character, much more deserving of a documentary than some of the stuff that they ran on public broadcasting. Now, I also knew that Trevor Thomas had some experience with television. He himself had been a commentator on KQED during a time when they used to have an hour-long news program every evening. So it occurred to me that maybe he and I could link up forces and do a proper documentary about Jack London, and it would give him a little extra to supplement his small Social Security benefit. I was going to bankroll the whole idea. And I somehow got the idea, and I don't even know now how it occurred to me. I would form a tax-exempt, a non-profit corporation to which we would invite contributions from friends and relatives and, to some extent, even from ourselves. And we would use the proceeds from that to support the production of cultural programs, such as an opening documentary about Jack London. I found that it was entirely possible for amateurs to organize a non-profit corporation by buying a book from the Nolo Press in Berkeley, which led you through the process step by step. And so that is exactly what we did. Trevor and I became co-directors of something called Antho Productions Incorporated. The word antho, consisting of an for Anderson and tho from Thomas. By coincidence, we found that the word antho is in fact a Greek word meaning flower. And so I designed a piece of stationery that featured a line drawing of some roses. So we began with my making a contribution to this nonprofit, which was tax deductible. And then we would pay Trevor $1,000 a month out of this fund. We hired a production crew, a professional video photographer, and went through interviews with a number of talking heads who knew something about the subject. We concentrated, of course, on Becky London herself, but we also had extensive interviews with a man named Russ Kingman, who had done a biography of London, a teacher at Sonoma State named Clarice Stas, who had done another biography, and so forth and so on. Well, unhappily, things began to go downhill when Trevor himself began to become increasingly forgetful. And one day, when I went down to meet him at his home on Rose Street, he had a long face and said that his car had been taken away from him. At least I think that he said he had not only lost his driver's license, but to make sure that he didn't drive his car without having the license, they impounded his car as well. And I never did get the whole story, but it seems that it was because they saw him driving around without seeming to know where he was, and that is, in fact, the problem. He didn't. He had forgotten how to find whatever address he was supposed to be looking for. I had never had any experience or knowledge of Alzheimer's. I don't think I had ever even heard the word. But Trevor had Alzheimer's, and it was very swift moving. And before long, he was dead. Those tapes still exist. They're a much better quality than my videotapes of Joe Murphy, because these were made by professionals, and they didn't come cheap. So maybe somebody can use some of them someday in some way. However, this was just one of many digressions. From the main concern to which I always eventually came home, and that was the farm labor movement. In 1993, Chavez died quite suddenly, and nobody really knows the cause. And there was a memorial in Delano that I attended along with Eugene Nelson, my friend with whom I had tried to co-author a biography of Joe Murphy, which hadn't panned out. And at this memorial service that attracted thousands and thousands of people, I renewed old acquaintance with Father Donald McDonald, and I found how to keep in touch with him, and in the very near term after this, I invited him where I was living at that time, which was Buckeye Avenue in Oakland, for the purpose of trying to get him talking about his experiences in San Jose, where he met Chavez and got Chavez interested in the papal encyclicals, which said that working men had not only the right, but the obligation to form associations for their betterment. Although these encyclicals didn't use the word union, they used the word association. But Father McDonald is the one who got Chavez from a job in stacking lumber in a lumber yard in San Jose to being concerned with social issues, and that really was what led to the events in Delano. Would never have happened if there had not been Donald McDonald in San Jose at just the right time. So I wanted to get his story because it was not being told in the many biographies that were being written about Chavez by this time, and are still being written. Most of them give a passing allusion to the name McDonald, but none of them give it the importance I think it deserved. So, Father McDonald came to my house there in Buckeye, and it was the most frustrating experience, because he didn't want to talk about the days in San Jose. He wanted to try to convert me to Catholicism. He had become very conservative in his advanced age. And I diplomatically tried to get him back on the track I was interested in, and he equally tried to get me onto the track he was interested in, and it ended up in a draw with neither of us achieving what he wanted. Every once in a while, somebody learned that I was still alive and I was still interested and in possession of most of my faculties, and they would want to pick my brains about AWOC or some other subject of which I had some knowledge. And I remember one author who had a manuscript that he called The Politics of Insurgency. And he looked upon the farm labor movement as an example of insurgency, I guess. And he had a chapter in this book in which he wrote about AWOC as well as some of the efforts at organization that had taken place before AWOC and those which had followed, including the Chavez Union. And he wanted me to go over this chapter and give him my opinion. I guess he wanted me to tell him that it was worth publishing. But I couldn't, because I didn't think it was worth publishing. It was full of factual errors and full of wrong interpretations of the facts, which, if anything, was even more unacceptable to me. So I didn't reply, and eventually I guess he figured that was my opinion. On other occasions, I was very willing to help people. People often wanted me to, sometimes wanted to interview me. And sometimes these interviews turned up later in articles or books. And so I was happy enough to take part in the movement in ways such as that, even though, despite my best efforts to get the facts right, they often somehow got warped somewhere along the line. When John London died in January of 1971, our book had just been published, and I often thought that the thing that kept her going during her last days, she was dying from lung cancer, the will to live is apparently a powerful one, and I really think that she kept going as long as she did in the hopes that she could actually hold that book in her hand before she died. And in fact, that is exactly what happened. And this story got into the hands of Herb Kane, who of course was the famous and popular gossip columnist for the San Francisco Chronicle. And so he dressed it up with as much pathos as he could. And he managed to get the title of the book wrong. It's called So Shall Ye Reap, but it came out So We Shall Reap. And from then on, I knew all I needed to know about Herb Cain, that almost everything in his column was...
I completely agree with that, by the way.
Of course.
He's a buffoon.
All right. In 19, I don't remember the exact date, somewhere along the line, a girl or woman named Sarah Ramirez who was on a PhD program in sociology at Stanford University, which was of more than normal interest to me because I also had at one time been on a PhD track in sociology at Stanford University. And Sarah Ramirez was proposing to write her dissertation on the subject of farm workers and pesticides. So this looked to be a match made in heaven. So she gave me a prospectus. What is my comment on that? I couldn't make any sense out of it. I didn't know how she could possibly succeed. In writing anything that made sense, but she went on and got a PhD, all right. Without me, she might have gotten some help from somebody else who knew the subject. Or maybe they gave her a pass because of affirmative action. I never did get anybody coming to me and asking for my opinion about the administration of these huge new medical care benefits under Medicare and Medicaid, which I have devoted a couple of years to studying and trying to arrive at some ways in which the fraud that was going on, or simply inefficiencies. It wasn't always deliberate dishonesty. And I did publish in the journal of the American Public Health Association an article that had some of our ideas for identifying the people who were abusing the system, that is, providers of service who were abusing the system. But nobody ever did. And I used to keep a box of clippings from the papers that would say that such and such a medical group or an individual, in some cases, had been found bleeding the system of millions of dollars after an investigation of several years, and it didn't seem to me that it would need to take several years if they knew what they were looking for. Eventually I gave it up because the box got overflowing with clippings. And it's still going on. However, on a happier note, from time to time, somebody would be referred to me by a mutual acquaintance, or in some cases, I guess they could find my name in the phone book, which is always there. Over the years, they would come to me wanting to talk about some aspect of the farm labor history and movement. And in the year 2000, a fellow by the name of Gilbert Gonzalez came here and told me about the fact he'd become very interested in the Bracero program, even though it had gone out of existence in 1964. But he was a teacher in Chicano studies at UC Irvine. And a remarkable number of the students in his classes indicated that their fathers, or in some cases their grandfathers, had originally come to the United States as braceros. And he had heard that I had done some work in the bracero program back in the 1950s. And so we talked at length. He became really interested in my work. So one thing led to another. And I put together a proposal that we make up a panel who would talk in one way or another about the subject of so-called guest worker programs. Because they were once again being discussed seriously as part of the so-called immigration reform bill that had passed in 1986. And I learned that the National Association, wait a minute, what? National Labor History Association was about to have its annual conference in Detroit, Michigan. And the theme of that year's conference, somehow or other, was relevant to the subject of guest workers or bracero history or whatever you might want to call it. So Gil and I divided up the subject, and I can't remember exactly what he talked about, but I wrote a paper called Braceros Speak that consisted largely of quotes from actual interviews with braceros that had been conducted during the course of my studies. And so I appeared there in October of 2001, I think it was. And it went over very, very well. Apparently, nobody else had ever actually studied the braceros while the program was still in existence. All of Gil's information came second and third hand. But people were very impressed by the fact that I had braceros talking about themselves in their own words, in translation, of course. And so after the panel broke up, I was surrounded by people who wanted to know more about my project and what had happened to my project and so forth and so on. And this was a peak experience for me, if I may use that phrase that I think I have once before. It's something I learned from the writings of Abraham Maslow. And I kept in touch with a couple of the people that I met on that occasion. One of them had a contact at the Bancroft Library in Berkeley. And she wrote to this fellow and suggested that he get in touch with me and get an oral history from me. And in due course he did. And I just wasn't prepared. In fact, I still am not fully. So I kept putting him off until eventually he retired. And I guess my habit of procrastination me into a vacuum that can no longer be filled. Anyway, the other woman, I have kept in touch with every once in a while, and she's still interested in the subject of foreign contract labor programs. I was so pleased by this experience that I began submitting proposals to the meetings of other labor history organizations. There was a Southwest Labor History Association that met annually. There was a Bay Area Labor History Association that met every month. It was headed by a fellow who lives in Oakland named Don Watson. And so every once in a while I would submit a proposal to one or the other of these organizations. And I would talk about not only the Bracero program, but the history of AWOC. And they were small compared to the National Labor History Group. But they were gratifying and resulted in a few years in a surprise at one of the annual meetings of the Southwest Labor History Association. It was held in Los Angeles. To my great surprise, during a plenary session that ended the conference, I was called to the front by the chairman, who presented me with a certificate. A Lifetime Achievement Award for my contributions to labor history. A complete surprise, and I have to put that down as another peak experience of my life. Let's see what time it's getting to be. I believe we're almost at 10:30. I mean, 6:30, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'll just say I'll just refer to one more interview that I had. They weren't always a great success.
What about the movie that Gilbert Gonzalez made?
Well, I'll have to come to that next time. I was interviewed by a woman who went to the trouble of hiring a professional crew. She was preparing a documentary on the contributions to the Delano movement by the Filipinos, who were in at the beginning and later drifted away. And so far as the general public knows, it was all Chicanos. But in fact, the Filipinos were very valuable in the beginnings of that movement. So she brought her interview crew, her production crew here one morning, and I was to talk about my friendship with Larry Itleong, who was the head of the Filipino community there. I hadn't had a wink of sleep that previous night, and I had a sore throat that made it, well, I must have sounded about the way I do right now. It was a fiasco, and I never have seen the resulting documentary. I don't know whether any of me survives in it, and I hope it doesn't, because if it does, it doesn't show me making any sense. That was one of my failures.
What year was that?
That was probably the mid 2007, 2008, something like that. So I don't want to make this sound as though it was one triumph after another, because it wasn't. But my relationship with Gil Gonzalez did mount as the years went by, and I would like to talk about that later.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.